I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. It's St. Patrick's Day weekend, but the celebrations may have to wait. Dublin has cancelled its parade, only one of the thousands of victims of the nearly month-old outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease in Europe, and that's not counting the animals. The well-known virus won't hurt you, but the terrors of tainted meat are the feeding ground for economic disaster. Start with hoofed animals, move on to farmers' livelihoods, to supermarkets, to tourist dollars, to national and international economies. The wildly contagious virus has Europe, and now the United States, tumbling amid disinfectants, export bans, and alarmist language. Britain is now the leper of Europe. That's one Irish official's description of the situation. In the last decade, globalization has made our borders more fluid. People, products, and information pass more freely than ever before. But now, crossing the border takes on a whole new meaning. And we're finding new reasons to rebuild the walls that globalism tore down. Connection listeners, what do we make of foot and mouth disease? Is it far away or is it right on our doorstep? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to make the foot and mouth connection. We're joined now on the line from London by Ben Gill. He's president of the National Farmers Union in Britain. Ben Gill, welcome to the program. Ben Gill, just paint a picture of what's going on in Britain at the moment. How many farms affected, the sort of siege mentality?
Well, the number of farms goes inexorably up. We're about 250 farms at the moment, but probably that's wrong. We've been getting about 20 to 25 outbreaks confirmed per day. And we're looking at slaughtering now in excess of around 250,000 head of livestock, with additional stock probably going to have to be slaughtered next week to try and create a form of barrier in the worst affected area up in the northwest of England and the southwest of Scotland, probably another 250,000, 300,000 head of stock there.
When this first broke out, it was said that this was certainly not going to be on the scale of 1967, the last big outbreak. It's far worse, isn't it?
In terms of the number of outbreaks, it isn't far worse, but because farming's become much more consolidated in terms of the number of livestock, it is definitely far worse. And, of course, everything's gone against us. The particular original outbreak, which was up in the northeast in the county of Northumberland, just north of Newcastle, that was spread right around the country by one consignment of sheep, which was traded a number of times, mixed with lots of other sheep, and it just fanned out from a number of loci.
Now, as you'll know, the US and the EU, European Union, are both looking at Britain and saying, you know, the dirty farms of Europe. What's your best guess, or what do you think actually caused this outbreak?
Well, let me take the first point. I don't know what you're saying in the States, but certainly the rest of Europe isn't saying we're the lepers of Europe. You've got one isolated junior Irish minister who's been ridiculed in his own country for the statements he's been made and has been countermanded by his senior minister and, in fact, the Taoiseach. What caused it? Well, it seems to have started in a pig farm up in the northeast of England, a pig farm that was a swill feeder, that's feeding leftover human food, which should have been boiled and should have killed off the foot-and-mouth virus. It's very easily killed by temperature, but something went wrong. The investigations are still ongoing. They'll be ongoing for some time. But even if we leave that aside, we have to ask, how did the infected meat get into the United Kingdom? It certainly doesn't conjure up out of air. It doesn't materialize out of thin air. It's not like the Invisible Man. It's got here from somehow. It's not a type that's found anywhere near Britain or Europe, for that matter. It's an Asian type. And that leaves us begging the question of the coincidence that only 6 months ago we had an outbreak of classical swine fever in our hogs. Thankfully now finished, all done and dusted, but that was an Asian type as well. And how did that get into Britain? And we don't know the answers to that.
Ben Gill, thanks. You're saying it started on one farm, maybe where there was bad practice, but basically you're saying the problem was imported. So let's hear now from Dr. Leanne Thomas at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She's the head veterinarian of the Office of Plant Protection and Quarantine. Dr. Thomas, welcome. Dr. Thomas, just tell us about the restrictions that you have imposed and why.
Yes, the restrictions we have posed is meat products that would be fresh, would have not been processed, would have been prohibited entry now into the United States. That also would include any movement of live animals, movement of semen, etc. Previously, actions related to BSE had prohibited the movement of many ruminant products from the EU. So primarily we're dealing with swine products that are coming in.
So you've banned meat, dairy, and live animals. Why act now? I mean, was it the fact that it moved from Britain to France that you decided the U.S. had to do something?
Well, we had shortly after, within a couple of hours of the U.K. announcing the outbreak, is we placed the prohibitions on the United Kingdom. And it was only at that time that France declared an official outbreak that we declared France to be infected with FMD. Currently, the USDA policy is we have a temporary hold on the rest of the EU member countries on primarily the swine products again. This temporary hold gives the USDA a time frame to evaluate the situation in the rest of the EU in regards to the measures that were in place and have been put in place to control further spread within the continental Europe.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, if you'd like to join into the conversation. I'm talking to Dr. Leanne Thomas of the USDA. Dr. Thomas, how serious is the risk? I mean, are these just sensible precautions and you don't think foot and mouth is ever going to come this side of the Atlantic, or is there a serious concern?
No, there is a serious concern, and that's evidenced by the fact that many of the procedures that we have in our ports of entry have been in place for 70 years. And to address the concerns of possible entry of foot and mouth disease on a traveler via his clothing or possibly his shoes, or in contaminated product that they may have in their suitcase or in their handbag or on their person.
Ben Gill of the National Farmers Union in Britain. First quick question, do you think this is a measured and reasonable response?
Well, I understand the response from the U.S. government. I should point out that at the same time, and I don't know whether it was exactly before or exactly after, the U.K. had already immediately imposed an export ban on all our livestock and meat products from the U.K. That is the standard procedure. It's the responsible procedure. Let me be quite clear. I wouldn't wish this on anybody. The strains my people are going through at the moment are intolerable. It's an uncertain fate for your livestock of many, many farmers not knowing who's going to be next, whether you're going to be hit, whether you'll lose your livelihood, whether you'll see all the stock that you've reared in many cases for decades built up by families destroyed in front of your eyes. It is a scourge that we ought to be looking in a coordinated way to getting rid of from the world, let alone from our own countries.
And indeed, and it's not just a problem for the farmers, is it? You said you wouldn't wish this on anybody. We said in the opening that you can't get ill. Humans are not affected.
That's right.
By foot and mouth. But the other impact is just unbelievable. I mean, Britain at the moment, you can't walk in the countryside. Parks are closed. I mean, it's a country under siege.
Well, there are large areas of the country that have been closed down simply because we didn't know where the virus was. And I had appealed 3 weeks ago to the British public to stay away from the countryside. We're looking at the moment how we can adapt those calls in the light of what we know now where the disease is. There's no problem with visiting London cities, the cities of Britain. There's no problem going to the coastal areas, the seaside, if you want to go there. What we don't want to mix is people from the grassland areas of UK with anybody else, and we don't want people to transfer between the regions because there are real suspicions that we have had that transfer going on already.
And how has this sort of affected the way the EU is working? I mean, it was supposed to be one great marketplace.
Yeah.
I mean, the barriers have just gone up again, haven't they?
Yeah, but there's provision for this, and it was within the EU regulations that we did in consultation with the EU put these barriers up. It's the correct way to do it. If we could have contained it to a part of the country, we could have lifted the barriers on part of the UK. At the moment, regrettably, we even have one case in Northern Ireland, and so that makes it impossible to do even that. So we're working across this ban on the entire UK for the time being.
Can I come to Dr. Leanne Thomas of the USDA? Dr. Thomas, there hasn't been an outbreak in the US for decades. Is that good luck or good management?
It's good management and possibly to some extent luck as well. However, and I don't want to make it seem in my other response that we're entirely complacent about this outbreak in the UK. Obviously, it's very serious, and we have heightened our awareness as well as increased our surveillance here. But it's very difficult until you know the exact pathway. It will be very informative for the U.S. if the U.K. is able to determine the pathway of entry. By that I mean, was it international garbage? Was it a food product? So we can perhaps specifically target a particular pathway coming into the United States.
Well, you heard that request, Ben Gill. The question has to be asked. I mean, even though you say, yes, the European Union's been very supportive, the perception is that Britain is very, very susceptible to this sort of thing. I mean, you know, mad cow disease stuff.
That's not perception in Europe. I've had telephone calls from all around Europe and from all the various governments. We've had it at ministerial level, at prime ministerial level, where everybody in Europe is saying, goodness there, but by the grace of God, go I. It could be anywhere it's got in. But Dr. Thomas is quite right. We need to find out how this got in. I've been alarmed at reports that have come out since this outbreak to find illegal domestic imports. I find stories of baggage handlers at our major airports saying they can smell meat, rotting meat, in hand baggage at the terminals there where they're handling the baggage, and reports of bigger containers of ostensibly vegetables on the manifold or fruit coming in with meat in the front of the cargoes. We can't afford to have this going on, and we have to be very much more vigilant. Certainly in Europe, we have not been as vigilant as the US has been. When I've been to the States before, you have to declare if you're a farmer or not, and you go through a procedure. Certainly when I go to New Zealand, it's even tighter. I've had my shoes taken away from me and fumigated. And I think that all shows sharply into focus. When you come into Europe at the moment, there are no such restraints. But we definitely need to try and identify how this product got in and look at every aspect. Of course, there are questions being raised. Why two different diseases in such a short time, both of Asian origin? What is happening? Is that a coincidence?
We can pick up that in a couple of minutes' time. I have to thank Dr. Leanne Thomas of the U.S. Department of Agriculture for joining us in this part of the program. She's head of the Office of Plant Protection and Quarantine at the USDA. We're going to take a short break. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11, the season of Lent. It's a lot more than Ash Wednesday, Palm Sunday.
This is The Connection. You've seen the pictures of burning cows in Britain. Foot and mouth disease has crossed the channel to France. 20 miles, just 3,000 miles, make America any safer in the age of globalization. Or is the big export panic? 800-423-8255, 800-423-8255. Talk, my guest today from the National Farmers Union in Britain, Ben Gill. And we're also joined now by David Ropeek, Director of Risk Communications at the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. Ben Gill, just before the break, we were talking about the fact that Britain has had two huge outbreaks. You need to find out why. That is the question. Why, and is panic the problem?
I don't think panic is the problem. I raise questions. There are all sorts of outbreaks of foot and mouth around the world now. We've seen a massive outbreak of this strain type in the Middle East in the last few days. And we need to know what's going on here. you're looking at the States 3,000 miles away from Europe, I think you have a major degree of protection there. And the problem is if people become careless. And what we need to do is try and identify what is going on. Is this somebody accidentally bringing it in? Is it somebody carelessly bringing it in? Is it just somebody having a cheap commercial offer and thinking they can get around the system? We don't know. Or is it even possibly, there's even an alternative theory, which is the conspiracy theory, that somebody is trying to destroy the livestock sectors elsewhere.
Now, of course, you understandably are desperate to make it clear that there is no link between mad cow disease and the foot and mouth outbreak. But the public perception is that Britain is blighted.
It certainly feels that way. My life has been hell for the last decade, and there are three totally unrelated events with foot and mouth disease, classical swine fever, and bovine spongiform encephalopathy, now, which we know is much more widespread than was previously thought, and which has been widespread for some time in countries like Switzerland and Portugal and the Republic of Ireland. Again, we need to understand all these factors and make sure they're clear. And what I found as I go around the world, the further you go away from the point of the problem, the less the understanding of the reality of the situation and more the embellishment of the risks and the disaster that's been.
Ben Gill, thanks, and David Ropeek, let's pick that up. Understanding the risks, is this the problem here? Is it panic?
Panic is perhaps too strong a word, but I think there are classic signs of an overreaction, if we can characterize it that way, to a new risk, at least here in the States. I can't speak knowledgeably about the UK or the continent. When people are confronted by a risk they haven't heard of, they don't understand, they're not familiar with, they haven't lived with for some time, the natural protective tendency is, probably served to get us up the evolutionary ladder after all, is to protect ourselves. There's a neuroscientist who uses the analogy of a snake and a stick in the woods that we were talking about earlier. If you come upon a line on the floor of the woods and you're not sure which it is, you don't do a risk analysis, you jump backwards. So we tend to overreact when we're first confronted by something with which we're not familiar.
Well, right. I mean, that's what your center does. It separates real risk from perception of risk. So have we got the perception here? Is the response adequate to what we've really got as opposed to pictures of burning cows being carted off onto a funeral pyre?
Well, there are a number of risks involved here. One is the risk that is economic to the agricultural industry, and I think it's probably worth stating at this point that, as best I understand it, this doesn't even kill the animals. Most of them recover, but they're less productive. So there's an economic loss, and it's pretty disastrous in a country like ours that has 100 million cattle. So there's a very real reason to protect ourselves from the risk, though the risk may be low of it getting in. On the other hand, the perception is a real risk, because if people are afraid of things and don't buy them, the economic impact comes not from the disease itself, but from the perception. They're both real.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Peg is on the line picking up that very point, the impact. Peg.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I do a lot of traveling in the UK. I'm actually planning to go there in June, although I might have to call my trip off at this point. And some of the friends I've been speaking with from places like Scotland and the West Midlands have mentioned the financial impact that goes so far beyond what people are buying or what the farmers are going through, as serious as that is. For example, one of my friends it maintains a sacred site, and no one is allowed, of course, to travel to any of these National Trust or English Heritage sites until this outbreak is contained. Another friend of mine is a musician up in Scotland, and a lot of his friends are going broke because pubs are closing because no one can travel in the countryside. Gigs are canceled. Concerts are canceled. And so people from all walks of life are very much affected economically, and it goes... I'm terrified to think, you know, how much worse this is going to get before it's all.
Well, right, Peg. I mean, do you and they feel this is just inconvenient, or do you think, yeah, there's a real risk here, and this is actually essential? What's going on is absolutely right.
I think it's also a larger problem, and if you don't mind, I'd like to comment on that, and that is that, you know, Americans as well as the British, we've become so far removed from caring about what the connection is between ourselves and where our food comes from. All we want is for it to be neatly packaged in some little store. We don't want to think about the fact that it was once on the hoof, you know, or that it had feathers. And I'm far from being a vegetarian, but I think if we cared a little bit more about the way that animals are treated and the way that animal husbandry has really taken a dive, only caring about production and profit, if we really treated animals in a more humane fashion and paid more attention to things like hygiene and overcrowding, and I mean, I know I'm simplifying this issue, but I mean, I think mad cow was a horrible specter that's still with us, and I think that the reason for that has a lot to do with these issues, that we just don't maintain that connection anymore. We don't want to think about our food as something that is this very, you know,
Peg,
very real thing.
Peg, thanks for that, and let's put that to Ben Gill, president of the National Farmers Union in Britain. Ben Gill, is that the link here? It's been said a lot in Britain as well, that it's the stack it high, sell it cheap supermarkets that's really perverted our food.
Well, before that, can I just correct a statement David made as well? He said there's no mortality. Mortality in young stock is alarmingly high. The mortality in our sheep that are just lambing now, for the young lambs, is about 90%. Now, it's that serious. And there's no symptoms. The animals just drop down dead of cardiac arrest. Now, the food industry, I think we need to have a proper debate, and I think it's time we have that debate. There's a lot of misunderstanding of what's going on and what the problems are. Certainly in the UK, the power of the retailers is absolutely enormous. The big three have about 60% of the market. They have muscle. In the States, when I've been there, my farming colleagues there have talked about the power of concentration, with the power not only of the retailers, but in the chain in between, where there are international conglomerates owning the feedstocks, slaughtering those animals, and in some cases, owning the animals.
Well, indeed, this is why it spreads like wildfire, isn't it? Because you've got fewer and fewer abattoirs, bigger and bigger farms, and it's all concentrated.
Well,
now,
that need not necessarily be the case. What happened here was not the fact that there were fewer abattoirs. It was the fact that one particular person, after the original infection, moved sheep several times in very rapid succession, mixing them with lots of other sheep on that occasion, and hence spread the disease round. Now, that didn't necessarily mean a big person. It just so happened he was. And that's what's caused the problem. And that's the point in terms of movements that we have to look at. And there's a very great push in Britain to have a change in that effect, and have that change quite quickly.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mary is on the line. Mary, you want to pick up that point, killing?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Judy, for taking my call. I spoke with my family in London a couple of days ago, my nephews especially, and they're absolutely distraught by the policy of mass slaughter. They feel that it's an overreaction by the authorities, especially the men in white that come. And, you know, we really haven't discussed this this position very well. And I understand that foot and mouth is not a threat to humans. It's been around for centuries. The animals are affected, but they are not deadly affected. And I'm wondering if we can begin to discuss this mass reaction or overreaction.
Mary, thanks for that. Let's put it to Ben Gill of the NFU. Ben Gill, you know, simple question. Why do you have to slaughter the animals if it doesn't kill them?
Well, as I've said, it does kill them. The mortality with young lambs is as high as 90%. And the effects on the animals is quite severe. The welfare effects are serious. In terms of in terms of milk yield, we can get depression in yields of as much as 75%, and obviously, therefore, the whole situation becomes untenable. Now, everybody who's tried to address this problem has looked at alternative ways of controlling it. Nobody likes killing animals, but when you see the way these animals suffer, you begin to realize there is no alternative. And the only way to stamp it out with this deadly virus, which is so virulent, and this is a particularly virulent virus, is to do just that, is to kill the animals and either burn them or render them down into the constituent parts, so killing off the virus. It's a disaster for every farmer who has to see his livestock killed. But there's no other way to do it, and that's historically been proved.
Ben Gill, on that rather grim note, thanks for joining us. I understand you have to dash off. It's Ben Gill, president of the National Farmers Union in Britain. But let's take that question up with an expert. Tom Yule is a specialist in viral diseases at the University of Wisconsin. Tom, you're welcome to The Connection.
You'll
have heard Mary there saying, do we have to kill them? Is killing the animals and burning them the only way? Is it the only way to stamp out this disease?
Well, regrettably, it is at the moment. The alternatives that one might normally think of, such as vaccination or very strict quarantines, are extremely difficult with this particular virus or this particular family of viruses, since foot and mouth disease comes in seven different flavors. But even dealing with just this one in the UK and now in Europe, in France, it's so difficult, it's so terribly transmissible, that it's very difficult to get ahead of it. And I think,
European Union thought that they were an FMD-free zone, didn't they? I mean, they stopped vaccinating 8 years ago.
Yes, they've been FMD-free since the 1967 outbreak. So the idea is the only really feasible way to try to halt the spread, given its transmissibility and that it can spread so rapidly, especially as these animals are moved both nationally and internationally very quickly, is unfortunately to try to pin the disease down in one geographic place and then stamp it out through slaughter and very strict quarantine.
Now, we were hearing from one of our callers earlier about this idea that it's intensive farming that's caused the problem. I mean, it is notable. This is an epidemic that's hit the first world. What is the comparison between the first world and the developing world?
Well, I think there are two factors that are involved, and certainly one is the intensification of animal agriculture, where you have very large concentrations of animals on a given farm, and the opportunity then for transmission of something like foot and mouth disease, or as Mr. Gill mentioned, classical swine fever, from one animal to the next, then becomes pretty high.
So is that a yes to it is intensive farming adds
well,
to it?
Well, that's part of it. But also the globalization of trade in animal and animal products is the other part of it that makes this particularly difficult. These animals, when they're ready to be sold, are gathered in lots. They're concentrated from many different farms. They are broken up then into lots and shipped to different places nationally and internationally. In the case of the UK, there's a special livestock ship that took them over to France.
Could I just ask you quickly, before we go to some of our calls who want to bring other issues, I mean, it almost sounds as if you're saying we want to turn back the clock, we want to have small local farms, we don't want to be shipping livestock across the waters or across the country, and that's the way that you actually prevent this sort of epidemic.
Well, I think that economic and political realities will not turn the clock back. What I think that means is that we need to be more vigilant about protecting the entry of these diseases in the first place, and that's why I think the point that Mr. Gill made and Dr. Thomas about trying to find out how this got in the first place so that measures can be taken to prevent it is absolutely essential piece of information. We've been quite fortunate here in the United States that what we have been doing so far has been successful in keeping it out.
Tom Yule, thanks. Let's hear from a farmer in Iowa now. Patrick, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Are you reassured or worried by what you've been hearing?
Actually, I'm quite reassured, and I'll tell you why. Just yesterday, what prompted my call was two researchers from the World Watch Institute wrote a very nice editorial that made its way into the International Herald Tribune and presumably a lot of other papers touching on this very point. I'm encouraged to hear a number of people calling in and saying, indicting properly the entire process of animal husbandry that promotes concentration, thousands of genetically uniform animals going into unhygienic warehouses.
Are you an organic farmer then?
Actually, I personally am not. I live in a county that has the highest amount of acreage under production of any county in Iowa, probably one of the strongest concentrations in the country. And it's working here. The point is, as one of your earlier callers said, it's probably a real good idea for us to have a better awareness of where our food comes from. This goes on to things like community-supported agriculture, for example, support your local farmers market. I'm not disputing that this isn't going to happen next week. I've acknowledged the global realities of things as they are done now. I think that this is just one more wake-up call, as these folks said yesterday. You know, this isn't going to go away if we keep on doing things the way we're doing things.
Patrick in Iowa, thanks very much. Let's hear from the other side. Now we've heard from the producer, let's hear from the consumer, and it sounds like a worried one. Liz, hi. No, I'm...
Hello,
Liz. Hello.
Yes. Hi. My question was, where is the reservoir in between these outbreaks? And is there anything we can do at that end of the spectrum to prevent these sort of problems?
Where is the reservoir? Well, I think we've...
Where is the virus when it's not actively causing the epidemics?
Well, I think we have a man who might know that, Tom Yule.
Yeah, would you like me to take a
Tom Yule
a
at University
that?
Of Wisconsin, yeah.
Yeah, well, what happens is there are outbreaks going on around the world, particularly in developing countries. So it isn't that the virus has disappeared. It's just that it's occurring somewhere else. And there are still many countries in the world where this disease is, the virus is endemic, and it just is there all the time. And it pops up. That's why there are these quarantine measures, and when you come in to the U.S., on the customs declaration form, you check whether you've been on a farm and whether you had meat products. So,
indeed, because you cannot kill this thing, can you? You can freeze the meat and it's still there.
That's correct, yeah.
And Tom, if I may interject, David Ropik here from the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. You've touched on something that's quite interesting. The fact that this has happened in the UK, where mad cow came before, it gives us a different perception of this risk than when the same risk pops up somewhere else.
We're talking foot and mouth this hour and global trade. Does the international marketplace make us all more vulnerable? I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. 800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, Lent. From Ash Wednesday to Easter Sunday, it's a time of fasting, abstinence...
...at Allaire.com.
I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection. Grim scenes across the Atlantic. Could the bovine funeral pyre become a feature of the American rural landscape, too? Are you cancelling your trip to Europe right now, along with your food hamper from France? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. My guests today are Tom Yule, specialist in viral diseases at the University of Wisconsin, and here in the studio, David Ropik, Director of Risk Communications at the Harvard Center for Risk Analysis. David Ropik, first of all, the way this has been handled in the media, the way America is perceiving this, I mean, you cannot imagine what's happening in Britain happening here.
No, but that's feeding the overreaction, the way we're handling it. And I want to get back to something that Mr. Gill said very early on in the program, that there are differences now.
Mr. Gill of the National Farmers Union.
Of the National Farmers Union, yes, from Britain. That there are differences now from when the last outbreak took place in the UK in 1967, and he cited the differences in the agricultural economy. I would point out another, which is the information world and the global nature of the world, and specifically the mad cow experience, which has done a couple things. It's formed the pattern in the developed world's head that cattle from the UK can have a disease, spread it to the continent that could spread globally in this now newly global marketplace. So we have a pattern that this seems similar to in the new stage. But there's also a more global information world. We hear about things more. The information is transmitted more than it was in 1967, certainly. And so when these outbreaks take place, particularly in parts of the world which the United States sees as like itself, if I may make that distinction, as opposed to the developing world where foot and mouth apparently is current most of the time in various places, we hear about that more, and it spreads the fear faster.
And there's a lot of greedy news machines out there, us included. But, I mean, there are two issues there. You know, you can't turn back the clock on mass communication, nor would you want to. But I think you're saying that had it not been for mad cow disease, this would have probably happened in Britain, and, you know, there wouldn't have been this kind of international, oh, my gosh.
I think there's a context that makes it worse than it might otherwise have been. We'd certainly have been afraid. The consequences are real. It's a real disease. It's worthy of fair journalistic attention. I think the context elevates to the overreaction stage, our reaction to this disease. And quite frankly, I think once we get familiar with the facts of it, we'll calm down faster than were it a threat to humans or a more serious disease in all of its risk parameters.
Well, let's see if the connection listeners are panicking or if they come. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Jack is on the line. Jack.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Ah, that's an English accent I can hear there.
That's right. I am English, and I'm enjoying this discussion very much. In fact, I left England out of life, intensive livestock production because I moved to the US because I was seeking to improve my career through working in more intensified livestock production in the United States. And my comment...
Gosh, you've been the bad guy on this program so far, haven't you?
Pardon?
Going into intensive farming, you've been portrayed as the bad guy. So,
well, I'd like to make a comment on that. My understanding is, I have a lot of friends in the United Kingdom who are in intensive livestock production. In fact, I'm in pig production, hog production. And my comment is this, that, and my understanding is that to date, no intensive livestock swine facilities in the United Kingdom have broken with foot and mouth disease. And that, in fact, the intensive livestock sector, particularly the hog production sector, because of the minimal disease restrictions that are in place and the way they manage their animal movements, have remained relatively free from this disease.
Well, Jack,
the problem is the movement of live animals around the country to ports where they get purchased and sold on, and moved in that manner. Properly run intensive livestock production, and I would say the U.S. is a good example of this, is not the vector of these diseases.
Jack, thanks for that. Let's put that point to Tom Yule, specialist in viral diseases at the University of Wisconsin. Tom Yule, is that right? There's no difference between non-intensive organic farms and intensively reared livestock. The problem comes in moving them, but it's not on the farm itself.
Well, certainly I would have to agree that animal movements have been a really critical factor in the UK in this current outbreak, and it's spread to Europe. And I think there's also the caller makes a good point about people seriously, producers seriously involved in intensive production, go to great lengths to put up barriers to prevent the entry of diseases into their herds, and that's certainly true. There are also some examples of when they break down, and I think we're all familiar with some of those where there is a lapse, and then once they do get in, then the spread can be facilitated by the fact that the animals are in large numbers and fairly close together.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. And I think Margot has the pickup question for that. Margot, hi. You'd like to ask something about intensive farming.
I would. I have a question, a two-part question and a comment. My question would be about, first of all, I'm wondering about the amount of antibiotics they use in Europe as compared to here, because I know on our non-organic, I only eat and use organic food and free-range. I eat free-range animals, same with my children, because of the amount of antibiotics that I can actually taste when I eat food that isn't produced that way. So I'm wondering how much they use compared to us, and are the organic farms affected as much by this as the ones that aren't.
Do I read in your question as well that you want to know if the reason that maybe intensive farms have safe food is because they're so pump full of drugs?
Well, I believe this is a warning from the Earth and from the animal kingdom about how we're treating the Earth and its inhabitants, including us, but the animals are sending us a message. We have the possibility to learn something from them here and to make the changes that are necessary. We can't just think about the political and the economical views. We have to think more holistically. It's like a big warning signal to me. I'm amazed it's not more obvious to people.
Viral specialist Tom Yule, is that the case, that intensive farms need lots of antibiotics to stay safe?
Well, antibiotics are used both to treat diseases and also to promote growth in some instances, and this is a hot and disputed topic that's been very much in the spotlight over several decades now, and I'm not in a position to compare Europe and the U.S. I just want to say that use of antibiotics has absolutely nothing to do with foot-and-mouth disease, in that antibiotics do not prevent foot-and-mouth disease or treat it. They might be used to treat secondary infections in areas where they're not doing the kind of slaughtering that's stamping out that's being done in the U.K. and Europe. So this is really a rather different issue for us to get into. If I could, Judy, just go back for a minute to the question of the earlier caller of reservoirs. There was one point that I'd like to touch on very briefly, and that's the role of wild animals. In Africa, there's certainly good evidence to show that there are reservoirs among the wild cloven-hoofed animals on that continent, and nobody yet has talked much about the risk that foot-and-mouth disease might play to wildlife, either in Europe, the UK, or here in the United States.
Is that why you need this mass slaughter, so that it doesn't transfer to the wildlife and then back to the livestock?
Well, that's certainly one of the factors involved, and the thing that would have us very concerned here, and perhaps David Ropeek will tell us we're a bit overreacting, but the risk that foot-and-mouth disease might get into the deer herd here in the state of Wisconsin, which at the moment numbers in excess of 1 million and will go up after the reproduction in the summer to nearly 2 million animals, and control of the disease were it to get into these herds would be extraordinarily difficult and expensive. And the historical example of that was the outbreak of foot-and-mouth disease, the last one we had here in the United States in 1928, which did get into a deer herd in the Stanislaus National Forest in California, and it took 2 years and a considerable effort to stamp it out. In a situation like the massive deer herd of the upper Midwestern United States, that would really be a formidable task.
Well, let's pick up another question we raised earlier, which was this one we briefly alluded to about vaccinations. David is on the line. David.
Oh, hello. Good show. I wonder about the political ramifications of vaccination. My understanding is that one of the reasons that vaccination is not practiced on a widespread scale is that if it is, then any country that's using vaccination has made effectively an admission that that country is not foot and mouth free, and therefore they can't export their products. Is this true? Is this a big factor?
Well, I'm going to put that to Tom Yule, because I was wondering about that myself.
Yeah,
why you stop vaccinating. Tom Yule in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Vaccination is practiced in countries where the disease is present and there are attempts being made to control it and not to eradicate it or to maintain a barrier, an immune barrier, to keep the country free. The problem with vaccines are essentially two. Vaccines are a lot better than they used to be, but they're still not very good in that they don't provide complete immunity. Some animals can still become infected despite the fact they've been vaccinated, and they can shed the virus. And so it doesn't provide the kind of really solid immunity that we have, say, with our yellow fever vaccines in humans. The other problem is that then once the animal is vaccinated, it responds with antibodies, and then one loses the ability to do antibody checks in populations as a monitoring device in the case of outbreaks. And so, because you can't tell whether the antibodies are there because of the vaccine or they're there because of the virus.
So it causes confusion and it's not very efficient.
Yeah, exactly.
David Ropeik, you were nodding there. I was wondering, we've heard that there's a lot of confusion. There's some hype, maybe some overreaction. What will be the task when this is over?
I want to touch on the overreaction issue that Tom raised. I meant to explain why the overreaction is happening rather than to chastise it for being so. So if I can make that distinction, thank you. Further, I think there's a long-range public health benefit from these sorts of overreactions. And if I can get back to the UK and the mad cow predecessor, if you will, there is a damaged public psyche in the UK and in Europe of mistrust in the government that's supposed to protect people.
And is that healthy?
In the long run, that's damaging, because then if we don't trust the German government, for example, in the case of mad cow, promised absolutely it will not happen here, and it took them a week to find the first sick animal. Trust in government destroyed, public fear goes up, the demand for reaction goes much higher, the amount of money spent on low risks gets elevated, and money spent on low risks to assuage public fear is not available for other actual higher public risks. So there's a threat from that. And in this case, and in any case where a risk pops up, an overreaction, if we want to qualify it as such, that helps in the long run to restore public trust in the government, whether it's the federal government in this country doing what it's doing for Mad Cow, a relatively low risk or not, establishes our trust in government and allows us to make more rational decisions about allocation of resources to all risks. In the long run, this may be an investment that benefits public health.
So let's see if we should trust the U.S. government, if they're doing the right things, and go to Tom Yule. Tom Yule, do you think that foot and mouth will reach here?
Well, I tend to be an internal optimist.
Don't you hate it when journalists ask you that?
And I don't think it will. I think the publicity that's been received will resonate with people here, and that they will alter their personal behavior and take precautions that otherwise they would simply have been unaware of. And so I think perhaps that's one of the side benefits of the dramatic scenes that we're seeing on television, because people, I think, will want to avoid having that sort of thing happen here. So
Tom Yule, we'll have to leave it there. Okay. Tom Yule of the University of Wisconsin, thanks. Also David Ropeik, Risk Communications Center at Harvard. You also heard Ben Gill from the National Farmers Union in Britain and Dr. Leanne Thomas from the USDA. Connection listeners, you can continue the foot and mouth conversation on our website at theconnection.org. I'm Judy Swallow. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.
This is